Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, August 25th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. The main story on the front page, course of action. Dubuque schools reopen with pandemic protocols in place. This is reported by Allie Hinga. Table Mound Elementary School students stood on orange dots placed 6 feet apart on Monday as they waited to go inside on the first day of school. But even though Tristan Hyatt's superhero-themed mask was a little itchy and he had to do a lot of standing before he could enter the building, the new fifth grader was thrilled to be back at school. He said, "I really miss school. I miss the playground. I miss the basketball court." Thousands of local students headed back to the classroom Monday as the Dubuque and Western Dubuque school districts and Holy Family Catholic Schools marked their first day of classes, along with students in many other school districts. It had been more than 5 months since Iowa schools closed their buildings in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Since then, staff and administrators have instituted a variety of new protocols to help mitigate the virus's spread. Students and educators say those changes will take some time getting used to, but they feel good about the school year and being back on campus, said Matthew Hull, principal. "I think there's definitely a lot of anticipation." He is principal at Table Mound. "I think people really want to do their best to keep everyone safe." After lining up outside, Table Mound students walked into the building past a sign on the front door that said, "Mask up, please," and a desk in the entryway with a bottle of hand sanitizer and extra face masks. The hallway was marked with X's made from blue tape, each 6 feet apart, to help students walk along the edges of the hall and to indicate where they should stand if they are stopped. Hull told students during morning announcements that he was excited to see them, but that, of course, this year will look different. They will wear masks, stay 6 feet apart, and use plenty of hand sanitizer. He told students that teachers will remind them of new rules and go over those procedures. "I know we can do it," Hull told students. Students such as fifth grader Samantha Lockel said they were happy to be back at school. Fourth grader Raylan Dolphin said she was excited to see everyone, even if she can't see all of her friends because students are currently rotating between in-person and remote learning days. She said wearing a face covering as required by the district is different, but that it wasn't too bad so far. "It does get a little hot, though, but I'm happy we'll at least get a couple of breaks with the masks off," she said. She said many of the changes around mitigating COVID-19 were ones that she was expecting. "I think it's a good idea," she said. "It's just a way to keep our distance so no one gets sick." As students at Table Mound were learning the ropes of the school year, students in other schools also were settling into their new routine. Western Dubuque High School students started off the day watching a video explaining the different changes in place this year, Principal Jacob Feldman said. Students are required to wear masks, and school staff spread out desks in the classrooms and made changes to lunch periods to minimize potential exposures to COVID-19. Feldman said students overall did a good job observing new procedures and that, other than the typical first-day anxieties, they seemed ready to be back. "When they came in, the energy in the building from our kids, they were anxious, but they were excited to be here, and that's what we're all about," he said. At Wallard High School, teachers have removed as much unnecessary furniture from their rooms as possible to spread out desks in the classroom. Principal Ron Myers said he figured desks are 4 to 5 feet apart in most classrooms. School leaders also reduced the capacity of the cafeteria and will put some Wallard students in the Mazzucchelli Catholic Middle School lunch area to help space students out. "We've been working with this all summer," Myers said. "Some of this stuff is becoming second nature." Junior Marco Morrell said he was glad to be back to in-person learning. Holy Family required students to participate in virtual instruction while buildings were closed, but it wasn't the same, he said. "I really am happy we're back in school," he said. Wallard Juniors Tessa Burning and Helena Stecklane said the requirement for students and staff to wear face coverings made them both feel safer while they were back in school. Elena said social distancing can be challenging during passing periods when students move freely through the halls, but she feels better because everyone is wearing masks. She said it was hard to breathe at first in a mask, but that she had been adjusting. "I'm fine now," Elena said. "I can breathe. I'm not as focused on it." She said that while the desks are spread farther apart than usual, many aspects of the school day are still familiar. Other than that, the environment is still the same, just more hand sanitizer, Elena said. The article is accompanied by several pictures on the front page by photographer of the Telegraph Herald, Dave Kettering, and Jessica Riley. One of the pictures shows students emerging from the yellow school bus at Farley Elementary School and Dexter Middle Intermediate School on Monday. And there's another picture of a webcam it's taken from behind the webcam, mounted on a tripod, and looking toward a classroom. The webcam will be used for those using virtual presence to the classroom. And there's a large picture of a large parking lot with students arrayed in social distancing spaces, everyone wearing a mask and carrying his or her backpack. And this is at Table Mound Elementary School, and the youngsters are chatting with one another from their distance of 6 feet, and the parking lot is sketched out with a number of hopscotch configurations. A second story on the front page, Supervisors Weigh County-Run Testing, reported by Benjamin Fisher. Butte County supervisors on Monday night directed staff to begin planning for a possible county-run COVID-19 testing operation. This mission was triggered by another week of testing levels lower than what the supervisors want to see, and significantly lower than they were at their peak. I am greatly concerned that we went from 3,000 tests a week to less than 1,000 a week, said Supervisor Jay Wickham. That's not a good way to understand what is happening with this disease. We need to increase the volume of testing. We've gone backwards in terms of testing. Wickham had been an early advocate for the county helming its own testing, proposing it several times early in the COVID-19 pandemic. The supervisors eventually appropriated $150,000 to the county health department to that end. But for months, local public health officials felt the county's testing needs were being met by a number of collaborations with the Iowa Department of Public Health and Office of Governor Kim Reynolds. Those culminated in the local Test Iowa Clinic at Epic Health and Wellness, which drove testing rates to new heights before being reined in by Reynolds' office. The process was changed to by appointment only. The testing rate dropped significantly and never returned. We're not turning people away, said Epic CEO Kelly McMahon, but during the meeting, the testing requests have gone down. She said she could not be sure why that is. The appointment process, more testing options in the area, lesser symptoms among the sick, less novelty with the clinic, or some other reason. Supervisors Dave Baker and Ann McDonough agreed that Interim Board Executive Director Ed Raber should begin compiling a possible plan, including costs and logistics. I support that too, but we need to know what it looks like, McDonough said. We need to see the costs. One other concern was confusion as to how the county would handle widespread outbreaks in the area's higher education institutions. Discussions continue between those institutions and the Iowa Department of Public Health, according to County Public Health Director Patrice Lambert. But she said there was still confusion about how testing would be handled on campuses. McMahon reported discussing the Dubuque Test Iowa Clinic's role, including the possibility of having to transport students to Epic from their respective campuses. Baker insisted that he did not want students traveling together in an enclosed bus. Sunnycrest Manor Administrator Chris Kirsch also announced Monday that the facility will be the recipient of rapid antigen test machines for COVID-19. The two machines, she said, would come with just enough collection kits to test staff and residents once. Then Sunnycrest would be responsible for resupplying to test all of the 270 combined people there. Kerr said that would run $30 per kit, bringing the cost to $8,100. And Kerr said the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are expected to soon require weekly testing of all those individuals, making that a recurring cost. The responsibility to the facilities is going to be great once those initial testing kits are used, she said. The article is accompanied by a picture of County Supervisor Jay Wickham. A third story on the front page, RV popularity booming as virus makes many rethink travel plans, reported by Jeff Montgomery. In the early spring, Ryan and Jamie Becker took inventory of the situation and braced themselves for the worst. Fears surrounding COVID-19 had halted many Americans' travel plans, compelling them instead to remain within the confines of their homes. Meanwhile, the pandemic had ushered in a swift and severe economic downturn. Neither trend seemed to bode well for Hawkeye RV, a business in southwest Wisconsin that has been in the Becker family for years. The family also owns Hawkeye Boat and RV sales in Dubuque. Said marketing manager Jamie Becker, anytime there is a recession or anything major happens, recreation gets left behind. Back in March, we thought we were in trouble. The total opposite has happened. As the summer nears its end, the Beckers reported that recreational vehicle sales this year are on pace to beat last year. They said business has been supported by an influx of first-time buyers, many of whom started to rethink their lifestyles and travel plans in the midst of a transformative year. The local business isn't the only one seeing that trend. The RV Industry Association reported that RV shipments to retailers topped 40,000 units in June, the latest month for which a report is available. That marks an 11% rise over the month in 2019 and marks the best single month since the fall of 2018. That has spelled good news for many RV manufacturers whose projections have shifted from gloomy to optimistic in the span of a few short months. In the early stages of the pandemic, RV maker Airstream was predicting a 70% drop in sales during the month of April. The company weathered the storm in that month, falling just 30%, and a subsequent uptick in orders has given rise to fears that the company won't be able to keep up with the rising demand. Another RV manufacturer, Marathon Coach, is forecasting sales in 2020 to finish 30% above 2019. At Brown's RV in Guttenberg, Iowa, the growing demand is frequently evident. Forrest Brown said he has noticed a nice uptick in sales in 2020 and attributes much of this growth to the fact that Americans are rethinking their concept of a vacation. After months of isolation, Brown believes that area families are eager to take a trip. However, the pandemic has forced many to consider everything from how they travel to where they stay. I believe that a lot of people are thinking about getting out and traveling, but a lot of them have some fears of staying in a hotel or flying, Brown said. An RV allows them to take a trip but avoid those things. A survey conducted by RV Industry Association uncovered a similar phenomenon. According to the association, the pandemic has increased RV interest in 20% of respondents. Becker, meanwhile, believes that a year defined by COVID-19 has fundamentally altered the way in which many Americans are leading their lives. Jam-packed schedules have suddenly loosened up and ushered in an era with more free time and flexibility. In turn, residents have finally had the time to slow down, appreciate the simple things, and reconnect with nature. People are grounded instead of going 100 miles per minute all the time, Becker said. It's brought people back down to earth. The unique conditions have brought a number of first-timers through the door, said Brown. Many opt to start out with the used unit when it comes time for their first RV, Brown said, but he believes many of them will invest in a new one once they get a taste of the RV life. While economic conditions aren't particularly rosy at the current moment, Brown said there still are plenty of people who view an RV as an expenditure worth making. A lot of our customers feel that the economy will straighten itself out and it will be strong once we get through this, he said. Those who are contemplating an RV purchase might want to act sooner rather than later. Ryan Becker, the owner of Hawkeye RV, said an increase in demand coupled with shutdowns at some manufacturers has led to delayed wait times for new units. Going forward, there will be a supply issue for a decent amount of time, Becker said. People who want an RV might be wise to scoop it up sooner rather than later. The article is accompanied by Jamie Becker and an aerial photo of an RV sales lot in Wisconsin. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, county reports one new case, lowest tally since June. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Monday's developments include just one new case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Dubuque County from 5 p.m. Sunday to 5 p.m. Monday, the lowest total for the 24-hour period ending at 5 p.m. since June 29. The county's total stood at 1,904 as of 5 p.m. Monday, which is the eighth highest total in the state. There were no additional related deaths in Dubuque County during the period, and nine people confirmed to have the coronavirus were hospitalized as of Sunday, according to the state data Monday. With one new case and 67 new tests reported, the 24-hour positivity was just 1.5%. During the 14-day period that ended at 5 p.m. Monday, there were 220 new confirmed cases and 2,211 new tests, equating to a positivity rate of 10%. The Telegraph Herald's calculation based on the state's totals continues to exceed the state's reported 14-day positivity rate due to the state's practice of not counting recent confirmed cases until all data is received, such as the date of birth of the testee. This practice drives down the positivity rate even though those cases have been confirmed in a recent county. The state on Monday calculated Dubuque County's 14-day positivity rate through Sunday at 6.9%. 20 more people with COVID-19 in the county were classified as recovered as of 5 p.m. Monday. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered from the number of confirmed cases, there were 495 active cases at that time, 19 fewer than 24 hours earlier. Jones County reported three more cases during the time frame, while Delaware County had one. No new cases were reported in Clayton or Jackson counties, but all four counties also reported few new tests completed during the period, ranging from 7 in Clayton County to 15 in Delaware County. Statewide, there were 359 new cases during the 24-hour period, pushing the total to 56,635. Eight more related deaths were recorded, so that toll rose to 1,044. In Wisconsin, Grant and Lafayette counties on Monday each reported two new cases, while Crawford and Iowa each had one. A free COVID-19 drive-through test site will be open from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, August 26, at Southwest Wisconsin Technical College's Public Safety Driving Track in Fenimore, which is accessible from Grant County F, south of U.S. 18. The site is open to the public, and no appointment is needed. The article is accompanied by a box of listed statistics for each of the counties in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And now we look at the opinion page. We have one letter from the editor titled Iowa Media's Coverage of Derecho Outstanding. And this is written by executive editor Amy Gilligan. Iowans added a word to their vocabulary this month. While weather buffs might have been familiar with the term derecho, became a household word after the August 10 storm blew through Iowa, wreaking havoc on its path. While the TH coverage area was largely missed by the gale-force winds, it did have an impact on our newsroom. Over the course of the last 18 months, folks in the Telegraph Herald newsroom have begun assisting with the production of several weekly newspapers owned by Woodward Communications Incorporated, our parent company. We are now composing the layout for papers in Mount Vernon, Solon, Marion, Anamosa, and several other communities. Several of WCI's weekly publications had solid coverage of the August 10 derecho despite their communities being getting hit hard, greatly complicating efforts to get out of paper. Mount Vernon, Solon, and others lost power for days, so the employees in those offices headed to Dubuque to set up camp in our newsroom and get papers out. Many of those that did have power lost internet access, and many lost cell phone use. Further complicating matters, the printer for many of these papers in Marshalltown was without power, and printing had to be quickly moved to another site. Having witnessed the around-the-clock efforts of these journalists and the production team, I was taken aback when I began to see social media posts decrying the lack of media coverage. The Telegraph Herald had derecho aftermath photos on its front page for the first 2 days after the storm, and the first three editions after it hit featured both local and regional stories detailing its impact. That coverage has continued ever since, with the newspaper running follow-up story after follow-up story. Soon after the storm, I pulled up the Cedar Rapids Gazette's website and was impressed to see the volumes of content they had already posted. The Gazette recognized its community was in crisis and quickly moved to make storm aftermath content accessible to all for free. TheGazette.com became a clearinghouse for information, directing readers toward food, water, shelter, assistance, and other resources, as well as directing people toward ways to donate or offer other help. Likewise, KCRG and Iowa Public Radio offered extensive coverage. When I saw the claims about a lack of media coverage, I poked around a bit and saw that ABC, NBC, and CBS covered the storm the day after. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post carried stories as well. CNN offered some coverage, too. For all the national media, though, derecho coverage paled in comparison to stories about Hurricane Isaias early this month and the two tropical storms advancing across the Caribbean last week. I suppose that's where the complaint began, and I know that national media attention is what it sometimes takes to get the attention of Washington and its powerful federal resources. A tweet by KCRG's Beth Malicki noted that the national media coverage was not like it had been with the flood of 2008. It was a fair concern. But a strange thing happens on the social media. Comments get misunderstood. Before long, there was a whole raft of posts about how no media was covering the derecho. I even got a couple of emails demanding to know why we hadn't had any coverage. We had. Iowa media had been covering the hell out of that story. It is because of the stories and photos these journalists provided that it did get national attention. The federal help might have been a step slow, but President Trump, Senator Joni Ernst, Representative A.B. Finkenauer, and others have been to Cedar Rapids. The National Guard came in, and federal funding is in the pipeline. A couple of lessons. First, when people talk about the media, it impacts journalists everywhere. I don't think that when someone says the media doesn't care, it's a reference to the editor of the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun, who managed to publish an outstanding paper full of storm coverage on August 13, even without power. But a comment like that feels like a slap just the same. Second, when you read something on social media, don't assume it's true. The people who complain to me about a lack of media coverage likely get their news from social media, not local newspapers, television stations, or even network news. For our part, our sister publications have continued to cover the storm, reporting on cleanup efforts, damage to key city and county buildings, and tips for readers on how to clean up and properly dispose of debris. And of course, they had fantastic photos. Some headlines. swath of destruction. Storm causes widespread destruction in Marion. From the Marion Times of August 13. 100 miles an hour. Inland hurricane blows through Solon and most of state. From the Solon Economist of August 13. Midwest derecho slams Linn County. From the Linn News Letter, August 18. Derecho 2020. Community recovering from storms. The Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun of August 20. National media is a different animal, and I can't speak to what drives their news coverage, but I was proud of the Iowa media and the coverage it continues to provide in the face of this devastating natural disaster. That was the letter from the editor by executive editor Amy Gilligan. And we have two letters to the editor. Data glitches reveal value of journalism. This is submitted by Andrea Bixler on Arlington Street, Dubuque. Thank you to Jeff Montgomery and the Telegraph Herald for continuing to push for explanations from the state of Iowa about mistakes in reporting COVID-19 positivity rates. This is an excellent example of the value of local newspapers and local reporting. While many Iowans have raised concerns about the issue, it seems unlikely we would have discovered the cause and extent of the misinformation without this dogged journalism. That was written by Andrea Bixler on Arlington Street in Dubuque. And our second letter is from Mike Maloney on Kent Court, Dubuque. Settling up with science. For a time now, we have been told that concerning global warming and the consequences that we should just follow the science, the mantra being, quote, the science is settled, unquote. And while it is true that there is a consensus on this topic, not all agree, so not 100%. Presently, with regard to the pandemic, we are told that the only way out is to once again, quote, follow the science, unquote. However, the science seems to change according to any number of factors, politics, opinion, etc. So let's just say not 100% here either. It seems to even the casual observer that science and the advocates that it needs to be followed has taken center stage in any number of topics. If a woman becomes pregnant and that pregnancy goes to fruition, then the outcome is a human. That is 100% and scientific to boot. Now the question is, does science apply across the board, according to Hoyle, or does it apply to only those instances which we want it to house rules? If the former is true, then abortion is technically the taking of a human life. If the second view is held, then it is not in keeping with scientific principles. So, in order to get to 100%, you have to convince everyone based on feelings and opinion. Dubious task at best. Maybe it might be time for a change, after all. Quote, the science is settled, unquote. That was written by Mike Maloney on Kent Court in Dubuque. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, August 25th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituary. And among our short listings, we have five. Carol B. Carroll, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Celebration of Life, 1 p.m. Saturday, August 29, on 12393 County Highway C in Prairie du Chien. Monty R. Dundee, Postville, Iowa, Celebration of Life, 2 to 6 p.m. Saturday, September 12, the Postville Fairgrounds. Robert W. Johnson, Galena, Illinois, services, noon Saturday, August 29, Glenwood Cemetery, Galena, visitation after 9 a.m. Saturday at the cemetery. Carol H. Oberbreckling, Guttenberg, Iowa, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 29, St. Mary Catholic Church, Guttenberg, visitation at 9:30 a.m. Saturday until the time of services at the church. And Lawrence L. Timmerman, Dickeyville, Wisconsin, Mass of Christian Burial, 11:30 a.m. today, Holy Ghost Catholic Church, Dickeyville, visitation 9:30 to 11:15 today at the church. And among our regular posted obituaries, Randall G. Apple, Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Randall G. Apple was 83 and was welcomed home by the Lord and Savior on August 22nd after being embraced in the loving arms of his family and friends at the Sharon S. Richardson Community Hospice, where he spent his last week. All who knew Randy are clear that he had a good life, lived by the principles of loyalty and love of family, God, and country. His faith in God was his touchstone as he courageously rode the rough seas of the last 3 years. Randy was a tough yet tender harmonica-playing Navy veteran turned insurance executive, a classy guy, quite an accomplishment for a regular fellow from Dubuque. What he was most proud of, beyond his sons snagging two wives and the photography of his sister, Sandy, were the friends, agents, and colleagues he had made over the decades at Acuity and Corey Insurance Associates. He was well respected for his hard work and willingness to go the extra mile for anyone. His compassionate heart, protected by his sarcastic and conservative rhetoric, was totally committed to the success of others. Before retiring, he was a passionate volunteer for the We Honor Veterans program at the Richardson Community Hospice and a regular liturgical reader at Holy Name of Jesus Catholic Church, where he was a longtime member. After retirement at age 79, he enjoyed the backyard fine-feathered friends, his gardening and political bantering, along with providing consultation with anyone looking for advice or help. Look under every rock and around every corner was his standard response. Randy married his first wife, Dee Fisher, when returning from his service in the Navy in 1957. His four sons and their wives, Jay, Tim, Debbie, and Kevin, Dana, Brian, Helen, along with his 10 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, have given him much joy. He met his second wife, Linda Cates, at the hospice where he said goodbye to Dee in 2009. After a period of pursuit, Randy was quite a salesman. She dubbed him Sparky. They were married in 2011. The family was expanded to include his stepdaughter, Michelle, and her 2 children, Brady and Brittany, and spouse, Ryan. A private family service for Ryan G. Apple will be held at the Reinbold Novak Funeral Home, Sheboygan, for family and closest friends on Thursday, August 27, at 11 a.m. A visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until the time of service. Cards and posts on the Reinbold website, reinboldfh.com, sharing the many stories of life with Randy, are welcomed. In lieu of flowers, please make a memorial contribution to the Sharon S. Richardson Community Hospice in Sheboygan Falls. From Elkader, Iowa, Suzanne J. Dolling died on She was 60, and she died on Monday, August 24. Graveside service, 10 a.m. Friday, August 28, at Union Cemetery in Littleport. Attendees should wear masks and practice social distancing. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Elkader is assisting the family of Suzanne J. Dolling. Donald J. Redinger from Huntsville, Alabama, was 73 and was born and raised in Dyersville. He passed away Thursday, August 20th, at a nursing home in Huntsville, Alabama. He survived by his loving wife, Karen, of 53 years, as well as his children and others, family members. The obituary says, Dad owned his own plastering company until he became injured, and he enjoyed spending time with the grandkids. He loved riding horses and shooting his guns. From Dubuque, Jerry A. Spiegelhalter, 66, died on Sunday, August 23. Visitation will be held 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thursday, August 27, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, where a service will be held at 1 p.m. for Jerry A. Spiegelhalter. From Savannah, Illinois, Lee R. Schmidt, 104, died on Wednesday, August 5. Cremation rites have been accorded. A graveside service will be held at a later date. The Law Jones Funeral Home is assisting the family of Lee R. Schmidt. From Frisco, Texas, Loris J. Nemers, 86, died on Wednesday, August 19. Graveside service with military honors will be held 11 a.m. Friday, August 28, at Mount Olivet Cemetery. The Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road is assisting the family of Loris J. Nemers. From Thompson, Illinois, Carolyn A. Schreiner, 76, died on Thursday, August 20. Cremation rites will be accorded and a Catholic committal service will take place at a later date. The Law Jones Funeral Home is assisting the family of Carolyn A. Schreiner. From Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Betty M. Decker, 91, died on February 18 in Sheboygan. A celebration of life will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 5th, at Hope United Methodist Church in Chadwick, Illinois. COVID-19 protocols are requested and required. Law Jones Funeral Home is assisting the family of Betty M. Decker. Charles W. Yeager, known as Bill, 77 of Dubuque, died Sunday, August 23 at his home after a courageous battle against cancer for over the last 10 years. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. today at Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home on Asbury Road. The funeral service for Bill will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, August 29, Grace United Methodist Church on Center Street in Geneseo, Illinois, with the Reverend Thomas C. Schinkel officiating. Family will receive friends at the church 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be in Oak Wood Cemetery in Geneseo. The service will be live streamed on Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at the funeral home website. Bill was born March 9, Geneseo, Illinois, and was born in 1943, the son of Willis Charles and Ethel Florence McKibben Yeager. If you are a Yeager, you knew him by Tad. On November 13, 1971, he married Barbara Ann Reich in Dubuque. He was a graduate of Geneseo High School. He received his bachelor's degree in business administration from Iowa Wesleyan College. He retired from Case International, where he worked in sales management. He was an active member of Grand View United Methodist Church in Dubuque, where he volunteered on a regular basis. Bill enjoyed hit-and-miss engines, farming, breakfast with the men's church group, joking around, and spending time with his family and friends. He was also a proud Republican. He was preceded in death by his parents, a stillborn daughter, Lisa Marie, and brother-in-law, Russell Brown. Memorials have been established for the Alzheimer's Association and the American Cancer Society for Charles W. Yeager of Dubuque. The Hoffman-Schneider Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of arrangements. Photo trivia can be viewed, and condolences sent to the family by visiting the Bill's website on the funeral home's website, Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen. From Platteville, Wisconsin, Lynette K. Richard, known as Lynn, 69, died on Friday, August 7 at a Grace Hospice, Fitchburg, Wisconsin. Celebration of life 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, August 29, at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. The family encourages everyone to be dressed in beach attire to celebrate Lynn's love of the beach. Burial will be at a later date at Immaculate Conception Catholic Cemetery, Keeler, Wisconsin. Memorials may be made to the Lynette Richard Memorial Fund, Post Office Box 245, Platteville, 53818. Online condolences for Lynette K. Richard at the funeral home website.
Richard, it's at the Malby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. And Lynette was born May 24th in Tyler, Texas, daughter of Harold and Corrine Schalecker Tice. She was married to Bill Richard on April 16, 1993, St. Augustine's Catholic Church, Platteville. She graduated from Woodstock High School, Woodstock, Illinois. Lynn worked as a floral designer for 30 years for various floral shops in Elgin, Illinois, Dubuque, Platteville, and Lancaster. She then worked at Kmart and was a teacher's aide at Westview School, Platteville. Lynn enjoyed doing cross-stitch, sewing, reading, and volunteering her time at the Senior Citizen and at Head Start. She was preceded in death by her parents, grandson, Chase, sister, Jan Bingham, and brother, Reverend Paul Tice. That was the obituary for Lynette K. Richard. From East Dubuque, Illinois, Eileen H. White, Eileen H. Stearman White, 92, died Friday, August 21. Private gatherings of friends and family will be held at a later date. The burial will be in Dubuque Memorial Gardens at a later date. The Bear Funeral Home on Main Street is in charge of arrangements for Eileen H. Stearman White. Deanna L. Webster, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, age 78, died on Sunday, August 23. Private family graveside services, 1 p.m. Saturday, August 29, at Hillside Cemetery in Lancaster. The Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is assisting the family of Deanna L. Webster. Elaine M. Zemke, 82, of Savannah, died on Friday, August 21. Public visitation, 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, August 27, at Law Jones Funeral Home in Savannah. Private funeral service will be held on Friday, August 28, with burial in Savannah Township Cemetery for Elaine M. Zemke. From Fort Atkinson, Iowa, Luella L. Meyer, 93, of rural Fort Atkinson, died on Saturday, August 23, in Ossian. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. today at Schmitz Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Ossian. It will be a private family service and burial, and attendees should observe the COVID-19 protocols for safety. And this was the obituary for Luella L. Meyer. And those are the obituaries listed in today's issue of the Telegraph Herald. On the sports page, we have a prep football story, optimistic Eagles, expectations on the rise in Marshall's second season. This is reported by Tim O'Neill. Dubuque Wallard opened the 2019 season with a monumental victory. The Golden Eagles are hoping for a few more of those this fall in Jamie Marshall's second season in charge. Charlie Fair said, "I think we have a lot of potential. We're going to take it one week at a time. We'll see how it goes, but we feel good about what we can do this year." Waller returns a plethora of starters this fall, including Fair, to a team that knocked off perennial powerhouse West Delaware in the season opener. The Eagles managed just two more wins the rest of the season, though, both shutouts over teams that finished the season 0-9 on its way to a 3-6 season. But that season was important for developmental reasons. Fair was sharing time at quarterback, and the team was in its first season under a new coach. Marshall said, "We're leaps and bounds ahead as far as where we were a year ago at this time because the kids are familiar with what we're doing on offense and defense. The players know what I expect. They know my personality, and they understand the playbook. So even though we were shortened due to COVID in June, we were able to pick things up and get things going at a much faster pace this year. Even coming out of July, we felt we were way ahead of where we were a year ago. The other thing I think that is probably more important is that I understand the skill set of each one of our players, and I know who needs the football in his or her hands, And there are multiple guys that do. In the same way on defense, you know who can play where, and who's a good blitzer, and who's a good coverage guy. It's great knowing the players a lot more this year. Fair completed 33 of 76 passes for 481 yards with 3 touchdowns and 3 interceptions before suffering a broken collarbone that put him in a sling for 6 weeks and prematurely ended his junior season. Obviously, it sucks having to watch from the sidelines, but it did actually help me see things, getting to take a step back, said Fair, who is also a standout tennis player. My first year on varsity, everything seems a little faster than it did before. So, being able to step back and trying to read a defense without trying to move 1,000 miles per hour while you're out there helped my development. We'll have a few trusty weapons to help out with returning running backs Gabe and Stetter, 411 yards, 3 touchdowns, and Jake Brosius, 207 yards, 2 touchdowns, both of whom also happen to be the team's top returning receivers after combining for 22 receptions and 239 yards and 2 touchdowns, said Anstetler, who made 46 tackles with 3 tackles for loss on defense. I think we all just need to be energetic on the football field. We worked very hard, and we know we can do it, but everyone's mind needs to be in the right place, and everyone needs to know we can do it as well. Nick Bandy, 9 receptions, 120 yards, and Landon Stahl, 3 receptions, 39 yards, also return at the skill positions for an offense that is 4 starting offensive linemen back for another season. Defensively, Waller lost their top 2 tackles, but returned playmakers at numerous spots. Ian Takis made 46 tackles to go with a co-team-high 2 interceptions. Stoll and Danny Steele both intercepted passes last year. Steele and Rodney Neely had a sack apiece last year, and Steele leads all returning players with 7 tackles for loss. Neely had 5 tackles for loss among his 17 tackles. Tyler Dodds, who will see time at running back, had a rushing touchdown, caught a pass for 12 yards, recovered 2 fumbles, and had 30 tackles. The Eagles will have a rematch of last year's monumental victory to open his 2020 season. Waller plays at West Delaware on Friday night. We've been working really hard all offseason, and we're really looking forward to getting out and competing again, Fair said. We feel really lucky to actually be one of the few states that's getting to play high school football this fall, and we really just want to take advantage of that opportunity. The article is accompanied by a picture of Dubuque Waller quarterback Charlie Fair, number 6, winding up to throw a pass in a game last year against Western Dubuque. Also on the front page of the sports section, Beckman player coach test positive for COVID-19, reported by Steve Ordman. With the 2020 Iowa prep football season just days away, Dyersville Beckman has already been put on the sidelines before taking the field. Trailblazers coach Mark Atwater confirmed with the Telegraph Herald on Monday night that one player and one member of the coaching staff tested positive for COVID-19 last week. Beckman will not play its scheduled season opener on Friday night at Iowa City Regina, which sent out a tweet on Monday that it was looking for a new opponent for its opener. We have a couple of positive cases, and we've got quite a few kids staying at home to quarantine because of that, Atwater said. Unfortunately, we will not be playing this Friday. We've had a few in quarantine for some time now, so we're going to try to be back next week. Atwater is holding out hope that the team will be able to suit up for their Week 2 date on September 4 to host Anamosa. We've been dealing with this since last week, and we're hoping to get everyone back at certain points this coming week with 2 separate cases, Atwater said. We're just hoping we'll have everyone back and can take the field next week. Beckman Vice Principal and Activities Director Todd Troutman told the Cedar Rapids Gazette that a member of the coaching staff took 5 players in a van to Cedar Rapids on August 16 to help with cleanup from the derecho storm that struck the city. The following Tuesday, the coach began to feel ill and, when tested, received a positive result, placing the 5 players under quarantine. Contact tracing has 11 Beckman players now under quarantine. It's been tough, Atwater said. Unfortunately,
I haven't been around the kids too much now, so it's been tough for me as well. It's disappointing. We waited a long time to get going on the season, and yeah, it sucks. But we understand what we're dealing with here and the safety measures involved. We just have to keep our eyes on the prize, and that's what this football season is about. Things like this might pop up and happen, but everyone makes the playoffs. And if we can get back on track and get back on the field for week two and beyond, that's what we'll strive for. Iowa schools are taking extreme measures to try and protect students and slow the spread of the coronavirus while returning to the classroom and fall sports, but Atwater believes Beckman's return to the classroom last week sparked a spread that may be hard to avoid in school hallways no matter the protocols. The big thing is we started school this past week, Thursday, and unfortunately, I'm just not sure how these kids in school are going to avoid these type of things, he said. Exposures are going to happen quick with them in class together, and it's so hard to keep them separated. This is different than Iowa's baseball and softball seasons, where they stay home or stay inside and just come out to play. We've got kids in school 8 hours a day, and to keep them separate is near impossible. We got hit with it pretty quick. The article is accompanied by a picture of Coach Mark Atwater. We'll look at a couple of news in brief stories as we have time. Dubuque schools, Western Dubuque, among those to have early releases today. Dubuque Community Schools and Holy Family Catholic Schools will have a 2-hour early release again on the second day of the school year today. Dubuque Community Schools said the decision was made given the forecast for very high heat index temperatures combined with students and staff transitioning to wearing masks during the school day. Similar conditions also prompted the early release of students Monday on the first day of school. Elsewhere, Western Dubuque, West Delaware, and Edgewood-Colesburg are among the other districts that announced early releases for today. And we have Dubuque-based manufacturer reports quarterly loss of nearly $26 million. A Dubuque-based manufacturing company on Monday reported nearly $26 million net loss for its fourth quarter and an even larger deficit for the fiscal year as whole. Flex Steel Industries reported total sales of $64.8 million in the quarter that ended June 30, down 35% compared to the same quarter the previous year. The company suffered a net loss of $25.7 million in the quarter, compared to a loss of $19.9 million in the same period in 2019. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, August 25th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.